I wanted to show a family who was pretty much a normal, regular family. They were generally good, decent people. And yet, you know, what is it about temptation in our lives that, you know, affects human nature? So I also wanted to delve into human nature and how it doesn't matter who you are, but you can be tempted, and who you are as a person will then determine your choice and your actions.
There's like a deeper meaning behind all of this. Like it's how you were raised, what you were taught, what you were conditioned to believe.
This is the Desi Condition.
Hello, hello. What's up, Bondhus? This is the Desi Condition. I'm Tanushree, and Anu is here. Hey, Anu.
Hey, everyone. I'm back again.
So we are talking to an author today. Krishma, do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. My name is Krishma Arora, and I'm the author of From Ash to Ashes, which is soon to be released in 2 weeks.
Yeah, so Anu and I read this recently. We got like an advanced copy, which made me feel very special. So we both got the book, we read, we like tore through it very quickly. It was a very engaging read. And what we really loved about it, and the reason that we wanted Krishma to be on the show, is that it's inspired from such a personal story. And it's about grief, which I think is really hard to talk about just in general, but especially how grief looks in the South Asian community and how families deal with grief. And it felt like a very real representation of how that might look in a typical South Asian family. So we're very excited to talk about this. We're very interested in everything that you have to say about that. So I think we can just get started first with, why did you write this book?
I wrote this book as a way of channeling my emotions after I had lost my son many years ago, almost 17 years ago. And I wasn't planning on making it a novel. I just started writing a story about a family who had lost their child, and they were grieving, and basically I just needed an outlet for my own emotions, because I really felt sort of trapped by my grief, and I didn't have a lot of other places to go. So I sort of chose my own creative channel, which was writing.
So what I noticed in your book is the family starts to kind of fall apart. The book is based on a tragedy. Like, that's the center of it, for the listeners. People kind of start to fall apart and fall away from each other, even though I feel like tragedy feels like something that should bring something together. And I think it does in some ways. But in this case, it actually creates division. Often it does. Why do you think that that happens?
I think that division happens between people and families, whether it's a couple or whether it's siblings or a family. And rather than bring them together, it makes them fall apart because people grieve differently. People react to loss differently. And oftentimes when you're not on the same page, you have different expectations from others that they can't fulfill for whatever reason. And oftentimes that can cause tension, it can cause miscommunication, and it can cause a lot of resentment, because grief is such a powerful emotion that oftentimes we're looking for somewhere or someone to put the blame on. And so people oftentimes blame each other for someone's loss, or you put blame on yourself. You feel guilt because you feel that you could have done more, or you could have helped the situation, or maybe you have caused it, or whatever the context may be. So I think that's why more often than not, grief tends to tear people apart rather than bring them together.
Krishma, I definitely wanted to talk about one of the major themes that I felt was prevalent in your book, and one of the major themes in our Desi culture, South Asian culture specifically, the notion of what will people say and that mentality. I felt that to be the strongest during throughout the grieving process for each person in the novel. So my next question to you is, how did the "what will people say" mentality impact your own grieving process?
Well, it definitely impacted me. The fact that, you know, I did not see a therapist right away after I lost my son was due to this whole notion of, what do you mean you're going to go see a psychologist? You know, what will people say that you need a shrink? What will other family members say? It's not even always about the outsider people or in the community. Sometimes it's within the families, how others may judge you. Whether it's an in-law or whether it's a spouse or whether it's a sibling. Oftentimes people in the South Asian culture are not comfortable with you going out into the world and talking to a stranger about your own personal problems and issues, including grief. And so that was one of the reasons why I didn't have access to any mental health at the time, which I so desperately needed, was because, you know, I was told that, you know, you're not crazy, you're just sad. Like, time will heal it, and you don't need medication to help you through this. You don't need talk to a stranger, you know, talk to your mother or talk to you. And then what I realized was, actually, it's not really helpful to talk to my mother, because my mother was also grieving and feeling the loss of her grandson. Mm-hmm. And she was probably the worst person to talk to, because by me talking about my grief, I was actually bringing her down, you know, further into the hole of it, rather than helping her come out of it. So sometimes it's so important to speak to someone who's not in the situation with you, so that they can give you a clearer perspective. So in a way, I was denied that. You know, what will people say? Like, what will people say if they thought that you need something for your anxiety or your depression? You know, we don't take medicine for that. Things like that. And also, what will people say if you're always crying, or if you always want to be isolated, or if you never want to go out and socialize again? People will say, like, you know, you need to start moving on, you need to start healing. But, you know, I wasn't ready for it. I wasn't ready to have another child. And in a way, I had to. I was sort of pressured. Well, you know, when another baby comes, you'll feel better. Well, no, that baby won't replace the baby that I've lost. But again, there's that pressure that you have to move on like this. There's no time to grieve.
You know? How did you combat that?
I can't believe people said
that.
Yeah,
that sucks. That's...
Yeah. I couldn't combat it. I was really in my weakest moment probably in my life ever. In my life had I experienced being at rock bottom, and I was. And so I couldn't put up a fight. I didn't have the will. And I did cry about it and say no, and that I didn't want to, and I wasn't ready. But it just seemed that the wills of everybody else, whether it's the in-laws or the spouse, or, you know, even your parents, whatever, is their advice, so-called advice, which was more like, you know, this is what you need to do now, is to have another baby. And I think, I mean, I'm so grateful that I have my son now, who is, you know, 17 years old, and I love him and I'm proud of him. But at that time, it was very difficult to jump into now have another baby and then deal with the postpartum depression and all that and pregnancy, and now care for another baby. It was too much mentally and physically.
Did you end up getting to talk to a therapist or a professional?
It wasn't until I had my third child. So I had my son who I lost. Yeah, I had my son who I lost. And then I had my other son, who is now the oldest, right after. 3 months later, I was pregnant again. And then I had another son. Two years after the second one, so the third son. And then not until he was about, oh my gosh, probably a year or 2 years old, two and a half years old, did I finally go see a therapist. I think It was almost 7 years later when it was to the point where I couldn't, like, I probably would have gone crazy if I hadn't seen one.
So what happened? Why finally after 7 years?
Because it was to the point where I, you know, started to, like, I just, it became a problem. Like, all those years I was able to sort of keep it in and, like, present myself that I'm okay now and I'm better now and I'm raising these two other new children now and I've got everything together. I'm throwing the kitty birthday parties. I've got the managing the house and the supermarket and the thing and my part-time job. But what I had done was I had repressed a lot of the emotions and the depression. And it was really starting to come out in extreme anxiety. And like there were times when I couldn't drive. Because all of a sudden I'd get triggered by something and the anxiety would come in. So it started to interfere with my everyday life where things were starting to fall apart. My relationship with my husband was more and more strained every year with the resentment of the loss plus the added pressure of having more children and taking care of them. And so it just came to the point where I still remember, and it's a very vulnerable thing to share, but I still remember I begged him. I said, I need help and I need you to help me get help. You know, even if you can't help me yourself, even though you tried, I need real help and I need you to support me with it. Because I was in a very fragile mental state, I think. And I think he finally saw that it had taken a real toll on me and like to the point where I couldn't function with a lot of things. So then he said, if you need to do this, then do it. If you need to take some antidepressant, then take it. If you need to talk to someone, then talk to someone. But because the whole family, we're falling apart, everything's falling apart, you need to pull yourself together. And so I finally did. Mm. And it literally saved my life. That's how important it is, mental health.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of repressing those emotions and not dealing with the issues in front.
Yeah.
I saw that in a lot of the characters in the book, several of them.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to ask you which character you resonate with the most.
So actually there's a piece of me in every character, you know, I am the grieving.
Yeah, mother. We definitely saw you in a couple of characters.
Yeah. I'm the grieving mother, right?
Of course.
Right. You know, she's has this feeling that she should feel, she wants to feel the pain of his loss because she feels that if she moves on, in a way she's forgetting him. And she didn't want to because she loved her son so much. He was a part of her body and her soul. And so you see her fighting to cling on to the grieving process. She doesn't want to heal yet. She wants to stay there. So that was definitely me. You know, I didn't feel like I should dare enjoy anything. I think anything that gave me pleasure, I felt guilty about it. And then I was also the main protagonist, Mira, in the story, because she was trying to grapple with the whole meaning of loss in the first place. Like, what is it? What is this universal meaning of our lives? And how is death and life and her religion and spirituality, how is everything that we've been taught and our beliefs and our values now actually, how can we reconcile them with the actual loss in life? It's one thing to read a book or to theorize, because I was a philosophy student and so is she in the novel. So I know a lot of theory and I understand a lot of things. But understanding and then actually living with those understandings, living those truths, is a very different process than reading and agreeing with certain things. So she was that part of her was me as well, and her character. And then, you know, you have the brother, you know, who is turns to alcohol because he wants to numb his senses. So, I mean, although I don't drink and I didn't turn to alcohol, there was that part of me that just wanted to be weak. I was just tired of fighting to be strong and to keep it all together. His weakness is my weakness. Just wanting to let everything fall apart because I was tired of trying to pretend like nothing had happened to me, that I was not traumatized.
Your story explored multiple instances of infidelity, which we found really interesting. So Tanushrina, I wanted to just ask you, why did you feel that that was important to cover?
So, like I said, when I first started writing the book, its purpose was to help me channel my own grief. And it was in a way as a self-help therapy. But as the story evolved and as the years passed and I evolved as a person, I decided that I wanted to include things in this novel that really affected the South Asian community after all, but were not discussed in the open. In fact, were often sort of swept under the rug, you know? And I decided it was time that, you know, somebody wrote about things that happen to people every day, and yet we go on like they don't happen. And so I wanted to show a family who was pretty much a normal, regular family. They were generally good, decent people. And yet, you know, what is it about temptation in our lives that, you know, affects human nature? So I also wanted to delve into human nature and how it doesn't matter who you are, but you can be tempted, and who you are as a person will then determine your choice and your actions. And because I think karma is also a big aspect of my story. And so, you know, you kind of see how it all kind of plays out with that. And I included it because I know so many people, and I've heard, you know, different friends and family members where these things happen in our community. But I, you know, you never like really see it or talk about it. It's always on a hush. And I just wanted to bring light to it, that relationships are complicated, you know, even old relationships.
I found that it added a sense of multidimensionality to many of the characters. Early on in the book, Mira talks about people in her life or situations in her life being black and white. And I felt that as I kept reading the book and as we kept learning more about these characters and just what their innermost thoughts were, they are so much more complex than they seem. And it was interesting that people were no longer in these boxes of good and bad and like, they wouldn't mm-hmm. do this or they would do this. And I think there's a really big aspect of that in just like Desi mentality where things are either good or bad.
Right.
And so there's just that like inner struggle I feel that every single character is going through with each and every one of their situations. Like, how should I act in this? But how do I really, really feel?
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting that you decided to like go down that path, and it added like a layer of like a lot of multidimensionality, like I said.
Yeah, and it felt also like we got to see them mature a little bit too through this process.
Yeah, that's how, like, that's why I go back and forth in time, so you can kind of see her as like a preteen and like a young teenager, and then when she's in college, and then of course later on as an adult, as a woman, you see her whole personality sort of blossom and flourish, you know. Yeah, and I decided to make all the characters have these layers because I wanted to show the complexity of human nature, that, you know, nobody is just good and bad, like you said. You know, there is nothing in life which is absolutely black and white. It is for children, but as we become older, we see that it's so much more complex. And the whole moral of the story, in a way you could say, was that what is it that we want from our lives? And what is our strength of character? And how are we going to steer ourselves through the notions of good and bad? You know, and just I wanted to show that at the end of the day, most people land somewhere in the middle. And that's okay, because that's the beauty of humanity, of human nature, right? We're not meant to be perfect. We're meant to have flaws. We're meant to make mistakes. We're meant to grow from those mistakes.
Yeah, I think that's also important to remember as people that want to support each other, especially through tragedy and times of grief. I think it's really important to remember that we're all imperfect, and that there's no, you know, one size fits all way to process something. I think that's definitely a message that can be taken away from that.
So speaking of these family dynamics and these like different layers in the people, we know that people deal with grief differently. They're affected in different ways. How does it, in your experience, affect marriage?
I think grief can really strain a marriage, especially when it has to do with the loss of your own child. It can put a lot of pressure on the spouse in terms of, because usually when something happens to you, you look to your spouse to offer you support. But the problem with grief is that both of you are grieving and you're looking to each other for support. But unfortunately, it doesn't always work so seamlessly, because oftentimes you're not able to support each other the way you necessarily want to be supported. So I wasn't supported by my husband in the way that I needed to be supported, although in his mind, he was supporting me doing what he thought I wanted or needed. And vice versa. He felt that I needed to support him in a certain way, which I wasn't ready to do. So this is the problem with grief. It causes so much tension because there's like a lapse between what the grieving person needs to heal, as well as the expectations one builds about, you know, from their spouse in terms of what do you expect? I mean, marriage in itself is work without grief, right? Without the added burden of having a loss and grief. So anyone who's married would tell you that making a relationship work in itself is compromise, is giving, is communication, is understanding. There's has to be a dialogue. There has to be an open-mindedness. There has to be the idea of, I'm going to have to accept you as you are. Whether I want you to be this way or not, this is who you are, and I'm going to have to deal with it. So that's why often, you know, I think I read somewhere that couples who lose their children, the majority of them end up divorced. And because it's such a great stressor in the marriage, it's a wonder how we survived all these years. We did very close to a breaking point, but then we managed to somehow patch it up and you know, to continue. I've been married, you know, over 20 years, so it's been a while, and we've been through a lot. So, I mean, now I can look back and say, yes, like, we've bonded through so much because we've gone through so much. But while we were going through it, it was very rocky and very stressful.
So throughout the book, a lot of the family members and the parents included, actually it wasn't the kids so much now that I'm thinking about it. It's the parents were very much like, this was God's will. This was God's will. Did you experience that in your personal life as well?
Oh, yes. Because when... you know, tragedy befell me personally. Everybody was looking towards some sort of explanation for it, but there was no explanation for it. It was just an accident, and it happened, and it could have happened to anyone else. And it was the whole idea of that it was God's will. And in a way, I had resigned to it as well, because the same year, like literally the same month that my son passed away, a tsunami hit Thailand. And I remember watching it on the news, and there was a baby who was 8 months old, a little boy who was in his crib, and his house was completely demolished, destroyed by the tsunami. And he was in his crib floating in the water in the ocean for, I think, 2 days or something. And on the third day, they found him. That child survived without food, without water, without being eaten by some fish or a shark or whatever, didn't fall into the water and drown, survived. And eventually they found his real parents through like DNA testing and all. The fact that that baby could survive such a huge disaster where thousands and thousands of people died, including other children, made me realize that it was the will of the universe. Let's put it that way. You know, it was his time to die, because we all are born and we don't know when we're going to die, but we all know 100% sure that one day that day will come. And for some of us, it's sooner. And for some of us, it's much later. And we don't know what determines it, but we do know it's sort of the will of, you could say God, you could say the universe, but whatever it is, it's something that we don't have control over. So I finally, after watching that, it sort of struck me that it was the will of the universe. Because if my child could die without a tsunami and this child survived, then he was meant to live and my son was not. So I had to resign to that true fact that my son was gone. And until I could not start taking the first steps to healing. Because I think the first like impediment to healing from loss and grief is the notion that people have in their heads that, why was this done to me? Why did it happen to me? Why did it happen to my son, to my family? You know, like my mother kept saying, well, why did it happen to my daughter? My daughter, who's never hurt a soul in her whole life, you know, her child, why did she have so much pain? And I finally, one day I said to my mom, I said, Mom, you have to stop this. I said, you have to now come to terms with the fact that this was meant to be. And, you know, this was God's will in a way. God's will or the universe's plan, however you see it or whatever you call it. But you can't change it. So stop making yourself and stop making me the victim. I'm not a victim. It wasn't a crime. It is just the natural state of life. With life comes death. And and that's what it is. So I won't be a victim to this. And I won't now spend my life pretending in the victim mentality. I don't want to do that. I want to get out of this. And I want to adopt a positive mentality. And it was from that that she was actually able to finally bring herself out of it.
Let's take a quick break from our episode. If you've listened this far, that means you probably like what you're listening to. So why not leave us a rating or a review, hopefully something nice, on Spotify or Apple Podcasts? And tell all your friends about the show, because you probably don't know this, but the Desi Condition is 100% run by people who do this as a side hobby. I myself, the founder, am a high school math teacher and a graduate student, and everyone involved either goes to school or works full time. All of this to say that TDC thrives on word of mouth only and doesn't make any money. And we're not trying to make money. We just want to spread the good word about mental health and wellness. So please take a moment to text your friends about this podcast or leave a rating to support the show. Let's go back to our regular content.
Is God's will the only way that we can come to terms with tragedy? And I want to look at this from like a South Asian perspective, like a South Asian lens specifically. There is a moment in the novel where that is said and it causes somewhat of an uproar, and with no spoilers, of course, I don't want to talk about what happened. But it was definitely thought provoking, because a lot of the God's will being, you know, the reasoning behind tragedy happening, and more so not even the reasoning, but more so like trying to console oneself and maybe justify certain actions and behaviors that people take that are less than perfect and less than kind and less than, you know, mature, whatever you want to call it. You know, how can you not resort to this is God's will and begin to take accountability for what has happened, or maybe even come to terms with your own personal actions or your reality if it wasn't something that was your fault? Like, that's part of the question. Mm-hmm. But let's start there.
Okay. Yeah. When I talked about my personal experience, I did resort to like the plan of the universe and God's will, because in my case, you know, there wasn't like something that led to something the way it does in the book. The reason why I brought this up in the book the way I did was because I wanted to show that in today's world, oftentimes people take so much hatred upon themselves for other groups, with, you know, other minority groups that either, you know, because of racial reasons, you know, other reasons why, you know, somebody comes in and shoots somebody else for whatever. I mean, I wanted to show that, yes, people are meant to die when they're meant to die, but at the same time, you know, it doesn't mean that you're not responsible for leading them to that death. You can be still, because in the story, the parents don't want to take any blame for the loss. And their daughter is trying to remind them, well, actually, you did have a hand to play in it, because you were not open-minded, because you chose hatred instead of love, you know, you chose to banish instead of to listen, you know, you chose to not embrace something, but rather you wanted to just wipe it off without actually thinking about what you were doing. You've had a hand in this death, in this loss. So you should not at all think that you can get away without feeling that you were responsible, because you were responsible. And so there is that notion of karma, you know, that your karma is, so everything you do in life, the choices that you make, how you treat other people, how you talk to someone else, how you make other people feel about themselves, all these things matter, you know, and you are responsible for that, for those behaviors, but also for your intentions. You know, even the intention to hurt somebody else is wrong. And so don't think, you know, so she tries to say to her father, to her, you know, her parents, that, you know, don't think that you can blame this on God, that God did this. So what did we do? You know, what did we know? Mm-hmm. You're also responsible for doing the wrong that you did. And I wanted to bring that out because I wanted to show how the face of intolerance and hatred is such that even a parent can forget that they're looking at their own child, you know? So what are we going to embrace at the end of the day? You know, this is what the novel is asking. Are we going to embrace love and acceptance? Or are we going to embrace divisiveness that leads down to a path of hate?
I think the notion of accountability being something that is so, like, it just, like, I felt like it induced fear of, like, facing oneself, at least in the novel. And I also feel like I, in my own personal life and just instances, like, you know, with my own parents who are, you know, from India, and I'm born and raised here. So just when having even conversations about anything, really, there is that wall of, like, no, like, this is just what's supposed to happen. This was meant to be. And even if, you know, either of us had a hand to play, there was just never that sense of accountability until much, much, much later, until we're so far removed from the situation and, you know, the grieving is essentially over. That's when I felt, you know, there was that accountability, but it was very, like, quiet. Do you think that we're built for that, like, in real time by society? Is that something that you feel that we are equipped to handle as we're grieving, or like as we're kind of coming to terms with something that we may have played a part in? Or do you think that's something that like culturally I feel, but, or do you think that's something that just, you know, has learned?
I think it's a part of human nature. I mean, it's definitely very predominant in the South Asian culture because of, you know, Eastern religions, whether you're a Hindu or a Sikh or a Buddhist or, you know, whatever, generally Eastern religions, you know, believe in karma. So you are accountable, but at the same time, there's this underlying destiny that you're also destined for. So it's sort of like dual, which is lovely because mm-hmm. it is complex as our lives. But like you said, I also think it's not just cultural. I think it's human nature. I think subconsciously we do everything to protect ourselves, right? We do everything to protect our physical selves and our mental selves. So when we are faced with such loss and trauma, our mind, I think, can't. The only way that our mind can process it is by not blaming ourselves, because then it would be too much. And it would sort of lead towards the sort of path that I was going towards in my own grief, which was the self-destructive path, where you blame yourself. Even if you were not at fault, you still blame yourself. And you think of yourself as unworthy. So you follow that self-destructive road. But most people don't. Most people tend to go the other way, which is, let me blame anybody else but myself. Let me not hold myself accountable. Let me hold others, point fingers at others, so that I don't have to bear the brunt of the guilt and of the shame or of the loss and of the pain. And I think that's very common of human nature.
I think the other way that I've seen God's will being used is when we talked about accountability, or trying to shirk the responsibility of accountability, but also in the realm of like a helplessness. I don't think that we saw that as much in the novel, because it was more about the accountability, refusing to take accountability. But in your personal life, did you or anyone else around you kind of use that as a way to just resign?
Yes, definitely. I definitely resigned to it because I couldn't change it, you know? I resigned to it because I couldn't understand why it happened. All I know is that it happened and that it does happen, that that's the nature of life. So did I want it to happen to my child? No, absolutely not. But I couldn't, there was no way to logically explain it. So the only thing to do was to accept it. And whether you accept your circumstances and call it God's will, or you accept your circumstances and not call it God's will, at the end of the day, you've resigned to your circumstances. And what I took from it was that whatever I was supposed to learn from this and build myself from this, you know, I'm learning from it and I'm building from it. Obviously, I didn't want to experience it, but now that I have experienced it, what am I going to do with this? How am I going to take this and live my life? Am I really going to let it destroy me and destroy my other two children who I now have and have the responsibility for caring? Or am I going to say that, or am I going to enter a positive mindset and say that, you know, I've grown so much and matured so much as a person. I see life so differently now. I value each breath, each moment so much more than ever. And I'm going to now teach that value of life and living and the smaller things in life to my children and so forth, and be kinder every day, you know, and be grateful for every moment. So, you know, I took from it what I could. Did I have to resign to it first? Yes, because if I hadn't, I couldn't have, in a way, If you're feeling guilty about things, then you can't forgive yourself if you don't.
Hmm. It's interesting. You say resign in sort of, you describe resigning as sort of a positive thing because it's like the catalyst for you to be able to move on, where my interpretation of the characters in the book was not so positive, that they were having issues moving on because they were, you know, using God's will as the reason. But obviously their situation is like different from yours. Their circumstances were very different.
And yeah, and I chose to do that purposely because I wanted to show how sometimes the grieving journey is so much longer than we think, that we're always affected by it. Even when you do move on in life and the years have passed and you see that with the characters, like you said, when they resign to God's will in a negative way in terms of, like they sort of took it on that it happened, but they never really moved on from it. Whereas in my life, I took it on as a positive note, as a way of healing. And I did that purposely because I wanted to show how not everyone is able to do that either, that many people are left stuck. And the reason being was in the novel, she talks about how Mira, the protagonist, was the only one in a way who was really able to find the positivity in her life afterwards. And the reason was she had that spiritual guidance and that inner willpower and strength, whereas her brother didn't. You know, he was sort of already lost and victimized and traumatized by other things. And this added to the pressure and he sort of succumbed. He, you know, was never able to build fruitful relationships, etc. So I wanted to show the realistic part of it, too. There are many people who are never able to fully heal from their loss and their grief. Mm-hmm. And that's why I kind of did that.
Yeah, and I thought it was a really beautiful way for you to also just address some of these societal issues that you brought up when, like, around those circumstances as well. Yeah, I think that was really important to do. So when you get to the point that you can accept responsibility and your hand in what happened, if we're speaking in terms of these characters, mm-hmm. or just even people from your family, how can they start to forgive themselves? How can they start to move forward?
And how did I forgive them? Is another question.
That's a great question.
Yeah. And I think that's what took the longest time, because sometimes, you see, what I realized was it was such a growing up process for me, this loss. What I realized was that, you can't expect people to even forgive themselves. Like, some people will never take on the responsibility and the accountability. And so they'll feel that they don't need to forgive themselves because they've done nothing wrong. And if you feel that you are the victim of someone else's mistreatment, which I did feel that I was, the resentment that I held towards them for years and years was actually only hurting me. The only person it was destroying was myself. And until I could finally forgive them wasn't until I could finally begin to heal. And by forgiving them meant that to realize, put myself in their shoes and realize, well, one, for example, for my husband, he was very young too. He was only in his mid-20s. He had never experienced a loss like this. He was never a father before this time. He also didn't know how to handle the situation. Maybe expect him to give what I needed at the time maybe was too much. Maybe he was only brought up to think about South Asian ideals such as, you know, one should not talk to strangers about their personal issues. You know, those were all things that I had been raised with as well, those type of old school values. But I was able to, in a way, rebel against them or to think outside of that box, but he wasn't able to. And so you can't really blame him for being raised the same way I was raised, you know? So I realized that, you know, I was also putting blame. And so I needed to stop and forgive if we wanted to move on. And that's what I did. In terms of the characters, however, they, Mira says towards the end of the book, she says that, she says to Dave, she says, you know, my family and I, we're made of the same fabric and we've been through a lot and I've forgiven them, you know, and the reason she forgave them was because she realized that, you know, at the end of the day, they didn't really know better. They were only acting according to how they were raised and the values that were instilled within them. And to completely blame them would be wrong, because at the end of the day, they only had, like, they only wanted the best for all their children, even though at times they couldn't deliver that. They, you know, their, what they thought was best was actually not best for their children. And so the fact that they were also struggling through understanding what happened and what they did, so she also forgives them. So in a way, I think it's so important to forgive others and to forgive yourself, because if we don't, we're expecting ourselves to be superhuman, because it's human to make mistakes. It's human to let others down. And we can't expect everything from everyone all the time. So I think that was a huge learning process.
We wanted to ask you what your experience was with the family other than your husband, and what was your experience with the family starting to fall apart after this tragedy? How did it shift the family dynamics, and how did you all heal from it and begin to actually address the issues between you?
My experience with the family was that there was some talk of, like, you know, like, well, whose fault? There was the blame game. And I just thought it was wrong, because it was really no one's fault. And, but, you know, I felt like the elders wanted to blame somebody for it. Like, either someone was irresponsible or negligent or whatever. And I just thought that wasn't fair. And then there was this great expectation from the family members that now that the grieving period is over, that I should just submit to what has happened, and I shouldn't be crying and moping around and not trying to move on with my life, but going backwards. And so I just felt like the family expected too much too soon. And I think there is no timetable for grieving. I think everybody grieves on their own timetable, and you have to allow them that space, which I wasn't given. And like I told you, you know, again, I was pressured to have another child right away, which was so much for me, because that would mean not being mentally prepared or even physically prepared. You know, now to again deal with morning sickness. I mean, it was bad enough being so mentally drained with everything that had happened, and then now also to be physically unwell as a result of another pregnancy. It was hard, and yet I was expected to just carry on with it. And if I tried to say anything, then I was called someone, you know, I was ungrateful, I was immature, or I was, you know, I was not doing the right thing. Basically, you know, I was criticized. And instead of being supported, I was criticized for anything and everything. So definitely that was that. And did we ever really resolve it down the road? I think many years later, maybe I brought up things, but, you know, people never said that that's right, that that was their mistake, or maybe they were too hasty, or maybe they were too harsh. No, they never admitted to their mistakes, because what I realized was a lot of people, especially a lot of the older generation, there's a lot of ego and there's a lot of pride. And for someone younger than you to kind of come to a realization which is correct and which is the truth, it doesn't matter. They will still do anything and say anything to protect themselves. And I encountered a lot of that. And then at the end of the day, again, I resented a lot of that. And then again, I realized how this is not serving me at all. This is only further leading me into a more negative mental attitude, and I don't want it. So you know what? I just realized it's better to forgive them. You know, they are who they are. And if they're not the bigger person or the better person that I expect them to be because they are elders, then that's their loss in their life. I don't necessarily have to take it upon myself and upon my journey of life. So I chose to forgive them as a way of resolving the issue within me. So
curious to know, how did you view... Go for it. Oh, what was I going to ask? My question was, when you mentioned feeling resentful, my question was going to be like, how did you feel throughout like the process of like, you know, feeling judged essentially and kind of being rushed into making decisions that you weren't ready for? I kind of felt like you just weren't being honored. How did you feel throughout that entire process? And like, did your core feelings change much or was it kind of the same? It sounds like you were able to forgive them after you had started the process of forgiving yourself also. So like, I guess that's what I wanted to ask. Was it necessary for you to first forgive yourself before you could forgive your family members for not showing up for you?
Yes, absolutely. I had to first, and the person actually who brought this to my attention, because I was playing the victim game for so many years. And finally, my sister said to me, she said, you know, you keep blaming everyone else, Krishna, but it's your fault that you let them do it to you. She said, it's your fault that you didn't stand up for yourself when you know you have the strength to do so. It's your fault that you let people walk all over you. She said, stop blaming everyone and stop letting everyone take control of your life. If you want to live in a certain way with a certain mindset, then go and do it. And I realized at that moment, I had never looked at myself in terms of like what I was doing. And because I couldn't in a way think about how I was accountable for anything, I guess I was blaming them too. So like you said, first I had to take care of everything that was going on within me. I had to forgive myself. I had to realize that I needed to I needed to ask for help. I needed to go out and get the help that I needed, regardless of what anyone else said or thought or judged me, like you said. I felt that I was being judged all the time, and that was causing me to have great anxiety. And I felt that I needed to be perfect all the time because I didn't feel worthy. So I had to get to a place where I finally felt that I was worthy enough and I was somebody and that I deserved to feel better, that I deserved to heal, that I deserved better. And once I did that, it didn't matter what anyone had said or thought or done because it didn't matter to my life. For me to move on. I didn't need their approval anymore. And so whatever they had done and said, when I had addressed it in a way, it was like, well, you did this. And even if you don't admit to it, it doesn't matter because I've forgiven you for it. And I've accepted you as with your flaws and you are who you are in this family dynamic. And so will I ever move forward in my life letting you make those decisions for me? Never. I will always be on my guard. But I've learned from it. And so in that way, yes, like I evolved. And it began with me forgiving myself, feeling that I am worthy before I could move forward to heal.
Did anyone else in your family end up seeking professional help?
That's a great question. Actually, no. No one did. And it's funny because even my mother grappled with it and struggled with it for years. And, you know, her solace was to do more and more prayers, more and more prayers. She wouldn't dream of seeing a therapist, you know. So I just thought that was interesting, okay, how I was the only one. My in-laws, the same thing. It was all left to prayers. My husband was different. He's not, he doesn't pray as much, but his was more like, let me fill my life with a new project that I can put my whole mind into to keep myself busy. You kind of see that with Ritu in the novel. She's the same way. She finds that she needs to move to a completely different new city, and she has a different like career path, and she just needs that to be an outlet for her to deal with her grief. So my husband was the same. He was looking to the external things to sort of help him heal. So everyone was very different, but I was the only one who actually needed help. And if you ask me why was I the only one? And I think it was because I was raised, even though I was born in India, I was raised here from kindergarten. And I remember throughout high school, if we ever had a problem, we could go speak to our counselor, our guidance mm-hmm. counselor. And my guidance counselor was a lovely lady. And whenever I had any issues or trouble, she would always talk to me. And I could always feel that I can go and talk to her. And some of my teachers were the same. And I feel like maybe that's why I became a teacher at the end of the day, because a lot of my high school mm-hmm. teachers were like role models, you know, they always could tell if I was having an off day, and they were always there to, lend a ear and listen and help me navigate through my issues. So I was used to that. I was used to going to someone else who was not in my family or in my friend circle to talk about personal issues. My husband was not. My husband was born and raised in Manchester in England, and he had a very private school, prep school upbringing, where it was like all boys school, even throughout high school, all boys. And it was just very, very academic and very proper. And no one even showed emotions. You were not even allowed to show emotions in your classroom. So maybe that's why, you know, maybe how we're raised affects everything that we do.
Yeah. Okay. Got you. So we just have a couple of questions for you, the person, as a writer, starting with, what do you envision for this future of South Asian creatives?
Mm-hmm. I think that I see more and more South Asian authors and poets and singers and actors and musicians, and I feel like a lot of them are embracing this open-minded culture where they want to sort of cancel out a lot of the old restrictive cultural values or rules or whatever you want to call them in South Asian culture, and sort of embrace a more accepting and open culture. And I think that's wonderful. I think that more and more people, like young South Asians who are born and raised here or in other countries, and even those in India or Pakistan or Bangladesh, I think I think it's amazing to see them embracing, the good of our culture, sort of preserving those good parts of our culture, but yet at the same time calling out the negatives of our culture and a lot of the double standards that exist in South Asian culture, as well as, the taboos that exist in our culture that we don't want to talk about, which are many of them are addressed in my novel. And I think that's wonderful. And I hope that they keep exploring their channels of creativity and bringing awareness to the community, within our community and the outside community.
And I think last question, what is the impact that you hope to leave with your work?
I hope that my work brings, is thought-provoking, that it makes people think about what's truly important in our life and how we as people and what we do and what we value truly impacts others, and how it's so important to be open and to be accepting. I just feel like the world, is a scary place today. I think that there's so much divisiveness in our society and so much hatred for others. And I wanted to show tidbits of that in my novel and show how, you know, when you follow the path of intolerance and hatred, it only leads to destructiveness and disaster. It doesn't lead to any good. But when you follow the path of openness and love, that's where true happiness and true contentment is, you know. And I just want people to know that, you know, as human nature, we can overcome so many obstacles. We can persevere. We just need hope, and we need, you know, to believe that there will be light, you know, out of the tunnel, you know, that we will get through darkness, and to always stay positive and to always choose love over hate.
Grishma, you are so smart and warm and strong. Thank you so much for being on the show. How do we find you? How do we get more of you?
Oh, thank you. So
for the listeners.
Thank you. So I myself have an Instagram page. It's called Grishma Writes. And I also have a TikTok account, which is actually, that's more about my humor and some South Asian culture as well. And then I have my website, www.krishmatuliarora.com, which has my blog, which contains a lot of my poetry and articles that I've written in the past. And it also has the links to order my book. And then you can find the book on Amazon, on barnesandnoble.com, on bookshop.org. It's available for pre-order at the minute. Yeah. So. I'm everywhere.
Yeah, we'll link all of that stuff in the episode description and on the website when we post about this episode. And again, thank you so much for being on the show. I think that people are really going to learn a lot from you, and I'm really looking forward to people just reading your book. And please, everyone that's listening, I think that this is a very important read for all South Asians.
Agreed. I definitely found it to be really thought-provoking. It made me think a lot about my own life, a lot of just so what some of my friends go through and my partner, like just a lot came to the surface. So I think you've achieved a lot with just this one book.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate all your comments about the book and about myself. And it was a pleasure, you know, talking with you both. And I'm, you know, so grateful that you had me on the show. Thank you.
Yeah. We're grateful that we had you.
Thank you for being here.
That is the end of our episode, Bondus. We hope you enjoyed this, and thank you so much for joining us on this journey. If you'd like to reach out to us, we can be found on Instagram and Facebook at The Desi Condition and on Twitter at TDC_Podcast. You can also email us at TheDesiCondition@gmail.com or visit our two websites, tdcpodcast.com and, of course, our Desi Creatives directory at desicollaborative.co. Stay safe, stay warm, make good choices, and we'll talk to you next time.